quickly. Let's look at each one of them. Authenticity. I've observed that a lot of leaders have a difficult time with authenticity. They don't want to let down their guard. They may feel that they are in a no-win situation. They worry that if they reveal their failures, they'll lose credibility. Yet if they try to hide their failures, they come across as phony. If they hide their successes, they fear they won't have much credibility. But if they highlight only their successes, they come across as arrogant and unrelatable. How does a leader navigate this situation? My advice to leaders is to try to live between the lines. Let me explain. As I travel the road of leadership, to my right is the line of success. When I'm over near that line, everything is going well, and I'm achieving success, and I'm winning. To my left is the line of failure. When I'm close to that line, nothing seems to do right or go right, and I'm living Murphy's Law. Anything that can go wrong will go wrong at the worst possible time. I describe these two extremes as the line of failure and the line of success. The line of failure states weakness versus the line of success, which states strength. The line of failure depresses me, and the line of success impresses me. The line of failure states I want to see no one, and yet the line of success, which states I want to see everyone. The line of failure states I want this never versus the line of success, which states I want this forever. The line of failure reflects me at my worst, whereas the line of success, it reflects me at my best. Most of the time, we live between those two lines. So when people see us on the success line, we have to be careful not to think that that is who we really are. We can be like the athlete who wins a gold medal or a Super Bowl and starts to believe that he's spectacular all the time in everything that he does. That's not reality. People may try to put such individuals on a pedestal, but they're going to surely fall off. There are also times when we travel along the failure line. We all make mistakes. We all make bad choices. We all fall short. If we believe that's who we are, we won't want to get out of bed. We shouldn't buy into that either. Both lines of success and failure are extremes. We're neither as good nor as bad as they might indicate. Authenticity is about living an open life between those lines. In my early years, I wanted to tell others about my experiences on the success line. I wanted to impress people. Now, as I've grown older, I feel the opposite pull, to share my failure so that I can encourage people. Because I'm a public figure, people often only see me at my best, not my worst. For that reason, some people give me more credit than I deserve, and that bothers me. Instead of wanting to point to my breakthroughs, I want to direct people to my brokenness that has led to my breakthroughs. I like to think myself as a mosaic made of many broken pieces. Author and blogger Rosalina Chai wrote a beautiful piece about mosaics that I find insightful. Mosaic is at once intricate yet majestic, and it's precisely its brokenness that lends mosaic its perception of fragile beauty. And isn't this true, too, of our humanity? What is it about brokenness that we find so offensive? What would happen when we accept and embrace that being broken is an essential part of humanity's being? What would happen when we cease to label brokenness as bad? What would it take for us to cease labeling brokenness as bad? I could imagine one certainty, more peace. Accepting and embracing brokenness is not the same as using another's brokenness to feel better about ourselves. Rather, it's an acknowledgement of our common humanity. And when I accept my own brokenness and do not judge myself harshly because of it, I find myself capable of more compassion towards others, regardless of whether I'm aware of the form of brokenness that they have experienced. Wholeness does not mean perfection. It means embracing brokenness as an integral part of our lives. My friend Max Lucado says, God would rather us walk with an occasional limp than a continual strut. I'm learning to embrace my limp because I'm learning so much. None of us is flawless. Good people do bad things, smart people do dumb things. We all find ourselves in moments where we feel tempted to do something we know in our hearts isn't the right thing, and we've all veered off course. It's humbling. Sharing that with others is authentic. Self-management. Author and speaker Ruth Haley Barton says, "We set young leaders up for a fall if we encourage them to envision what they can do before they consider the kind of person they should be." What she's speaking about is the strengthening of character that comes from good self-management. Character is not about intelligence, it's about making right choices. David Gergen, the political commentator who worked in several White House administrations, points out that if intelligence and character were the same things, Presidents Nixon and Clinton would have been two of the best. Gergen said capacity counts. But once a candidate passes that test, character counts even more. Many leaders score high on IQ but low on CQ, character quotient. To increase our CQ, we need to practice self-management. One of the best ways to help ourselves do that is to establish character guardrails for ourselves to keep us from going off course. On a highway, guardrails keep cars from going over a cliff. With them in place, you may crash, but you likely won't die. When it comes to character, I believe the best guardrails are the decisions you make before you face high-pressure situations. It's easier to manage yourself if you've already made the tough decisions related to your values. It's impossible to maintain good character when you don't know what you value. Do you value honesty, integrity? Then what is your guardrail? What won't you do? Decide that before you face temptation. Do you value relationship? If so, what is your guardrail? What must you do to maintain relationships? Identify your values and decide what boundaries you won't cross long before you may be tempted to cross them. I wrote about this concept in my book, Today Matters. Many of the value decisions I've made were subtle when I was in my teens and 20s, but I still have to manage myself in areas where I'm vulnerable to character pitfalls. For example, when you get to be my age and you've experienced some level of success, people start to give you honors and awards. I can't allow any of that to go to my head. My mentor Fred Smith taught me that the gift is greater than the person, meaning that a person may accomplish much even though he or she is highly flawed. I know I am. I'm not as good as some people give me credit for being. I believe that whatever gifts I possess were given to me by God, and I deserve no credit for them. My focus needs to remain on building my integrity, not my image. To keep myself grounded, I ask myself some questions. Consistency. Am I the same person no matter who I'm with? Choices. Do I make decisions that are best for others even when another choice would benefit me? Credit. Am I quick to recognize others for their efforts and contributions to my success? If I can answer yes to these questions, then there's a good chance I'm not getting off track in this area. Where are you susceptible to character pitfalls? What values do you hold dear? What decisions do you need to make before you face temptation? What questions do you need to continually ask yourself to manage yourself? These are some of the most important things you can think about as a leader, because if you can keep yourself on the road and from going over the cliff, you can continue to lead others and make a difference. Humility. Nobody likes working with a leader who is full of himself and works only for his own benefit. People want to work with a leader who displays humility. What does it mean to be humble? I like what Robert Murnau wrote in Humility, Reflections of Christian Values. He said of humility, "It is that habitual quality whereby we live in the truth of things, the truth that we are creatures and not the Creator, the truth that our life is a composite of good and evil, light and darkness, the truth that in our littleness we have been given extravagant dignity." Humility is saying a radical yes to the human condition. I love that. Yes, we are flawed. Yes, we make mistakes. Yes, we are human. That's okay. Dale Carnegie said, if you tell me how you get your feeling of importance, I'll tell you what you are. Where and how we seek validation impacts character. As a young man, I wanted to make a big splash. That's what was important to me. In the beginning, it was all about me, my goals, and my success. Slowly, I realized that I was not on earth to see how important I could become, but to see how much of a difference I could make in the lives of others. Artist John Ruskin asserted, I believe that the first test of a truly great man is his humility. I don't mean by humility doubt of his power, but really great men have a curious feeling that the greatness is not of them, but through them. For most people, humility has to be earned. It has to be developed over time as you accept your weaknesses and give grace to others for theirs. In college, I read these words written by Thomas A. Kempis. Be not angry that you cannot make others as you wish them to be, since you cannot make yourself as you wish to be. That made a strong impression on me because at that time, I did want to change others. I had to learn how to focus on changing and improving myself. That happens only when you acknowledge that your flaws are great enough that they need to be addressed. That requires and creates humility. And when you begin to develop humility, you're in a better position to serve the people that you lead. Courage. Courage makes character possible. It empowers us to do what's right in the face of fear, fatigue, or uncertainty. Character is not developed in ease and quiet. Only through experience and trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened. There are times in every leader's life when he feels obligated to take people where he himself has not yet gone, to talk farther than he has walked. I know that has been true for me. At such times, I did not feel competent enough, experienced enough, strong enough, faithful enough, wise enough, or qualified enough. At those times, I must acknowledge my weaknesses, ask for God and others to help me, and summon the courage to take action. Continuing to live a life of character requires ongoing reflection, brutal honesty, and courage to do the right thing. And sometimes we have to work to restore good character after making bad decisions. That takes time, intentionality, and effort. Recently, one of my John Maxwell team coaches sent me a poem about leadership and character after attending one of our training events. I think it captures the courage required to develop and maintain character. It's entitled, The Mirror and Me. When I look in the mirror, what do I see? Reflections of a double-sided me. One side is everything I ever hoped to be, yet my greatest problem is staring back at me. There are times when I rush out to get ahead and to find myself leading when I need to be led. Courage is needed. How can I overcome me? How can I lead others with authenticity? I will remember the best and the worst in me, and doing this will keep me growing humbly. I will seek others out more faithful than me, and I will ask for help with my vulnerabilities. To lead and do right, that is my possibility. To do this, I will visit my mirror regularly. If you want to develop the kind of character that will sustain you as a leader, then embrace the four dimensions to character: authenticity, self-management, humility, and encourage. And never be afraid to admit that you are wrong. Doing so is like saying you are wiser today than you were yesterday. Number three, character makes you bigger on the inside than the outside. Plutarch, an ancient Greek philosopher, said, what we achieve inwardly will change outer reality. That has always been true. Character is built on the inside before it shows up on the outside. The difference between our inner and outer selves is described by New York Times columnist David Brooks, based on a book that influenced him, Lonely Man of Faith by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. Brooks said that the people feel the pull of their internal and external selves, which are a reflection of Adam from the Old Testament. In Genesis, the creation of Adam is described twice, and these two descriptions characterize the divided nature within all of us. Brooks called them Adam 1 and Adam 2. Adam 1 wants to build, create, produce, and discover things. He wants to have high status and win victories. Adam 2 is the internal Adam. Adam 2 wants to embody certain moral qualities. Adam 2 wants to have a serene inner character, a quiet but solid sense of right and wrong, not only to do good, but to be good. Adam 2 wants to love intimately, to sacrifice self in the service of others, and to live in obedience to some transcendent truth, to have a cohesive inner soul that honors creation and one's own possibilities. The world cheers for the Adam 1 in all of us. But I believe when we focus on developing Adam 2, we choose the kind of character that is able to sustain us, that is able to fuel and give wisdom to the first Adam in all of us. As Brooks said of that inner character, it lives by an inverse logic. It's moral logic, not an economic one. You have to give to receive. You have to surrender to something outside yourself to gain strength within yourself. You have to conquer your desire to get what you crave. Success leads to the greatest failure, which is pride. Failure leads to the greatest success, which is humility and learning. In order to fulfill yourself, you have to forget yourself. In order to find yourself, you have to lose yourself. The inner voice wants to make you bigger on the inside, and the outer voice wants to make you bigger on the outside. The voice you listen to wins the battle. When your inner voice says, I have done wrong, you have a chance to deal with the feelings of character, incongruence, or hypocrisy by making changes. That allows you to regain your character equilibrium. The outer voice encourages you to appear bigger on the outside, often at the expense of who you are on the inside. It creates a cognitive dissonance, an unhealthy hypocrisy. That outer voice might say something like, what I say and what I do are not the same and never will be. That's the way it is. Just keep up appearances. That's not a good road for anyone to go down. It's especially bad for leaders because they can become inauthentic, rationalizing, and unteachable. I deal with this tension all the time. I know that what I say and what I do are not always in alignment, but I'm working on becoming more consistent. I'm not there yet, but I'm getting there. I don't give heed to the outer voice, which encourages image. I try to listen to the inner voice, which encourages integrity. To develop character and become bigger on the inside than the outside, I must deal with my weaknesses. I must embrace failure and learn from it. I must choose the better path forward. For years, I had an accountability partner who each month would ask me 5 questions that dealt with my character. The last question he always asked was, have you lied to any of the 4 previous questions? And often I would have to say yes, and we would go back, and I would have to confess my fault. That last question was designed to keep me from developing a divided life. Activist and founder of the Center of Courage and Renewal, Parker J. Palmer, described what happens when we allow ourselves to become divided. I pay a steep price when I live a divided life, feeling fraudulent, anxious about being found out, and depressed by the fact that I'm denying my own selfhood. The people around me pay a price as well, for now they walk on ground made unstable by my dividedness. How can I affirm another's identity when I deny my own? How can I trust another's integrity when I defy my own? A fault line runs down the middle of my life, and whenever it cracks open, divorcing my words and actions from the truth I hold within, things around me get shaky and they start to fall apart. The result of developing strong character on the inside is self-respect, which comes not from accomplishments or achievements, but from making the right choices. Brooks wrote, "It is earned by being better than you used to be, by being dependable in times of testing, straight in times of temptation. It emerges in one who is morally dependable. Self-respect is produced by inner triumphs, not external ones. By focusing on internal character, we also care for our souls. John Ortberg offered some keen insight into this in his book, Soul Keeping. Your soul is what integrates your will, which is your intentions, your mind, which is your thoughts and feelings, your values and conscience, and your body, your face, body language, actions, into a single life. A soul is healthy, well-ordered, when there's harmony between these three entities and God's intent for all creation. When you're connected with God and other people in life, you have a healthy soul. Ortberg went on to explain, our world has replaced the word soul with the word self, and they are not the same. The more we focus on selves, the more we neglect our souls. A healthy soul is whole. It's not fractured. It has an internal integrity. Integrity means more than following a moral code. Integrity is defined as the quality or state of being complete, an unbroken condition, wholeness, entirety. Its Latin root is the same as the word integer, a whole number. It's the opposite of being divided. A divided life separates us from our soul. A life that is whole strengthens our character and makes us bigger on the inside. When our souls lose that wholeness on the inside, we struggle on the outside. As Ortberg said, referring to an experience trying to ride a mechanical bull, if your soul lacks a center, when life comes at you fast, you'll be thrown off the bull. No matter how hard you try to hold on, eventually you'll get thrown. The soul without a center finds its identity in externals. Where do you look to establish your identity? At your image, your accomplishments, your recognition? Or do you get it from your internal character? Do you focus on making right choices or improving yourself, on following through with your commitments, on nurturing the health of your soul? If you focus on the outside, you will neglect the inside. However, if you focus on the outside will always benefit. Recently, I read an article about Theo Epstein, the president of baseball operations for the Chicago Cubs. People began recognizing him because of the 2016, the Cubs finally won the World Series, something that hadn't happened since 1908. He had worked for several teams, including the Boston Red Sox, before going to Chicago, but by the time he got there, he had learned the importance of character. I used to scoff at it when I first took the job at Boston, Epstein said. Referring to a focus on character, I just felt like, you know how we're going to win? By getting guys who get on base more than the other team and by getting pitchers who miss bats and get ground balls. Talent wins. But it's like every year I did the job, I just developed a greater appreciation for how much the human element matters and how much more you can achieve as a team when you have players who care about winning, care about each other, develop those relationships, and have those conversations. It creates an environment where the sum is greater than the parts. Epstein was hired as the Cubs president in October 2011, and in January 2012 he met all the organization's managers, coaches, trainers, and operations personnel. They spent one day talking about hitting, one on pitching, one on defense and base running, and one on character. Those became the foundation to achieve the one goal Epstein had for the organization, to win a world championship. In his fifth season with a young team, Epstein was on the cusp of achieving that goal. Sports Illustrated writer Tom Ferducci said the defining moment occurred during a rain delay after the ninth inning of Game 7, after the Indians came back to tie the game. The young Cubs team didn't crack. They didn't shrink. They didn't stumble. What did they do? The players called a meeting. Ferducci wrote, the Cubs packed shoulder to shoulder for a players-only meeting in a small weight room behind the visiting dugout at Progressive Field. He called it a strong visual of Epstein's ideals of collaboration and character. In the top of the 10th, the Cubs scored 2 runs. It was enough to win the game with a score of 8-7. The Cubs' character carried them through when they needed it, and that's what we should all work for. Whether we're team members or leaders of the team, character always counts. Developing the person of character within you. So how do you focus on developing character from the inside out? I believe the core of character boils down to three main things: embracing good values, practicing self-leadership, and valuing people. Embrace good values. If you've never thought through your personal values and written them down, then you need to do so. What are your non-negotiables? What lines will you refuse to cross? What will you stand for? If you've already gone through this process, then look at what you wrote out previously and verify your list. Has anything changed? Is there anything you would add? Anything that you would remove? Practice self-leadership. The essence of self-leadership is doing the right thing even when you don't want to do it, and not doing the wrong thing even when you do want to do it. I call this managing the decision after I've made it. Let me explain. When you determine your values, you've already decided what you will and won't do. Then when you face a difficult moment, your job is to follow through on a decision that you've already made. What must you do to put yourself in a better position to manage your decisions and follow through with them? Value people. By placing others first, you take the focus off yourself and therefore have a more difficult time being selfish. That builds your character. Think about something that you can do every day to express value to another person, especially to people you don't have an affinity for or don't especially like. And don't forget, you can receive free bonus materials from me at maxwellleader.com. Chapter 4, The Ultimate Test of Leadership, Creating Positive Change. Several years ago, I had the opportunity to play at Augusta National Golf Club as the guest of Lou Holtz. If you're a college football fan, you know about Lou. He's an American icon. In 1988, he coached the Notre Dame Fighting Irish football team to an undefeated season and a national championship. One of my favorite quotes from Lou, which he said the first time I met him over lunch, is, "I've coached good players and I've coached bad players, and I'm a better coach with good players." Well, Lou is known for his dry wit, and I spent three unforgettable days with Lou at Augusta. And during the day, we enjoyed playing golf on one of the world's best courses, and Lou kept us in stitches. Lou was the first off the tee that first day, and he teed it up, and hit it, and immediately started walking toward the hole. "What's he doing?" I thought to myself, and I turned to Harvey McKay, Lou's good friend, who was playing with us, and said, "Lou didn't wait for the rest of us to hit." "He never does," replied Harvey. "He can't stand still." It was true. All 3 days, Lou would hit off the tee and start walking, and needless to say, many times we would yell, "Four!" as our golf balls flew toward Lou, and he would just cover the back of his head with his arm and keep on walking. I've never seen anything like it. If we were playing too slowly for Lou, he would say, "Hey, try to keep up with the group behind you." If one of us was taking too much time lining up a putt, Lou would say, "Putt before I die, will you?" I'll never forget those rounds on the golf course, but my favorite time at Augusta were when we were sitting in the cabin late at night and talking to Lou about his college coaching career. From 1969 to 2004, Lou coached at 6 different universities. None of the teams were winners when he took them over. What's remarkable is by his second year of coaching, every team, not only did they have a winning record, but every team was invited to play in a college bowl game. That's an amazing accomplishment. Leading a team to that kind of success once or twice is a major feat. But 6 times? I listened with interest as our cabin conversation centered around making the changes necessary to turn a losing football team into a winning one in such a short time. Lou Holtz is a leader who understands how to create positive change. He's what I like to call a U-turn leader, a person who is able to take an organization that is heading downward, stop the negative momentum, change the direction it's heading, and turn it upward, creating a positive momentum. George Kelly, a career coach who worked with Holtz at Notre Dame, said Lou had 3 qualities all great coaches possess. One, he didn't take anything for granted. He was an excellent teacher, and he was superbly organized. On top of that, Lou is a positive visionary. He changed the cultures of the teams he led. That created his team's success. Being able to turn an organization around by being a positive change agent is the true test of a great leader. Nearly anyone can get out in front of people who are already going in the right direction and encourage them to keep going. Very few can make the changes necessary to turn around a group of people who are headed the wrong direction. Leading change can be difficult. Any person who has led change knows it's challenging, but I believe that people do not naturally resist change. They resist being changed. Recently, I saw a two-frame cartoon in which the leader asked, "Who wants change?" And every hand is raised. But in the second frame, when he asked, "Who wants to change?" not one hand is raised. That pretty much characterizes human nature. We want the benefits of positive change without the pain of making the change ourselves. Why is that? I believe there are several reasons. Number one, people feel awkward and self-conscious doing something new. You see, change is awkward. Just ask your hands. Don't believe me? Try this. Clasp your hands together, palm to palm, with your fingers interlaced. Which thumb is on top? Everybody naturally favors putting one thumb over the other and alternating their other fingers accordingly. Is your right thumb on top of your left? Whichever way you clasp your hands, it feels natural. You're naturally doing it the same way every time. Now switch them. Unclasp your hands and interlace your fingers again, but this time, put the other thumb on top. Now how does that feel? Awkward, I bet. If you're like most people, you'll feel a strong impulse to switch back to your regular way. I had a similar problem with my golf game. When I graduated from high school, I received a set of golf clubs as a gift. I welcomed the opportunity to try out a new sport, so I just started playing golf without any kind of coaching. I was a reasonably good athlete, so I was able to get out on the course and play, but I never could improve my game no matter what I tried. When I finally took golf lessons from a pro, he told me my self-taught grip and swing were the things that were holding me back. His solution was to ask me to change everything. Boy, did that feel awkward. I knew I needed to make the changes, but none of them felt right. Over the next few months, any time I was under pressure to make a good shot, I found myself returning to the security of my old grip, because I felt more comfortable with the old way of playing, even though the new way afforded me the opportunity for great improvement. Over time, I became comfortable with the change, but it took a while. Most people are more comfortable with old problems than new solutions because the new represents the unknown. Author and speaker Marilyn Ferguson put it this way, "It's not so much that we are afraid of change or so in love with the old ways, but it's that place in between that we fear. It's like being between trapezes. It's Linus when his blanket is in the dryer. There's nothing to hold on to." Number two, people initially focus on what they will have to give up. When people hear that change is coming, the first thing they do is ask, "How is this going to affect me?" Why? Because they are worried that they will have to give up something. Sometimes that question makes a lot of sense, such as when you're in danger of losing your job or your home. But most of the time, life is a series of trades anyway. Poet Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "For everything you gain, you lose something." So it's unrealistic to expect not to give up anything. However, many people are holding on so tightly to what they have that they are willing to forgo gaining anything, even progress. As leaders, we need to help people overcome this attitude. I think personality type and life experience impact people's attitude in this area. For example, some people are savers while others are throwers. I'm a thrower. As soon as I think I don't need something, I toss it in the trash. I don't think there's been a day in my adult life that I haven't had to dig around in the trash can for a piece of paper I threw away before I was actually done with it. Throwing things away gives me great joy. It's just one of my quirks. Most people are more like my wife, Margaret. She's a saver. If she thinks she might use something in the future, she sees no reason to get rid of it. I'll say this, she's not a hoarder. She's very organized, so her home isn't cluttered. But if I had my way, our motto would be, if we buy something new today, let's give something else away. Not only do we want to hold on to things, we also tend to hold on to ideas and ways of doing things. Authors Eric Harvey and Steve Ventura have written about this human tendency. The fact is, we all carry a certain amount of counterproductive cerebral baggage that weighs us down and holds us back. Our loads include everything from once-valid beliefs and practices that have outlived their usefulness to misinformation and misconceptions that we've accepted and sometimes embraced without much examination of thought. Why care about baggage? Because it negatively impacts us, the people we work with, the environment we work in, the results we get. Simply stated, whatever we accept and believe determines how we behave. And how we behave determines what we achieve or don't achieve. Their solution, our brains are like closets, they say. Over time, they are filled with things we no longer use, things that don't fit. Every once in a while, they need to be cleaned out. Peter Drucker, who has been called the founder of modern management, said that he believed that businesses needed to put every product and their process they have on trial for their lives every 3 years. Otherwise, he believed the competition would pass the business by. Bill Gates had a similar perspective. He recognized that products Microsoft made would become obsolete in 3 years. The only question, Gates said, is whether we will make it obsolete or someone else will. I'd say he understands the price of change and is willing to pay for it as a leader. Number three, people are afraid of being ridiculed. People who do something different always run the risk of being mocked or ridiculed, and that can be a great deterrent to change. Author Malcolm Gladwell recently did a podcast on this subject that looked at the Hall of Fame basketball player Wilt Chamberlain. He was called the big man who can't shoot. Chamberlain, who played professionally from 1959 to 1963, was a dominating center who set multiple NBA records, but he was also known for being a notoriously bad free throw shooter. His career average was 51%, but in 1961-62 season, Chamberlain tried changing something in his game to improve free throws. Instead of doing the traditional overhead shot that nearly all basketball players currently use, Chamberlain tried to use the style employed by Rick Barry, who at that time was the game's best free throw shooter. Chamberlain used the granny shot, where he held the ball between his legs and shot it underhand. Rick Barry's career free throw percentage was over 89%. In the podcast with Gladwell, Barry explained why he decided to use that motion to shoot free throws his entire career. From the physics standpoint, it's a much better way to shoot. Less things can go wrong, less things that have you to worry about repeating properly in order for it to be successful. But the other thing is, who walks around like this, raising his hand up in front of him? This is not a natural position. When I shoot underhand in free throws, where are my arms? Hanging straight down, the way they are normally. And so I'm totally and completely relaxed. It's not in the position where I have to worry about my muscles getting tense or tight. And then the shot itself. It's a much softer shot. So many of my shots, even if they're a little off, they hit so nice and soft, they still fall into the basket. While experimenting with Barry's underhand shooting method for free throws, on March 2, 1962, Chamberlain did something no one had ever done before and no one has ever done since. He scored 100 points in the NBA game. That night, 28 of those points came from free throws. He made 28 of 30 from the line. Despite his success, Chamberlain gave up the granny shot and went back to his old way of shooting and his old habit of missing. Why? He was embarrassed by it. Gladwell quotes what Chamberlain wrote in his autobiography. I felt silly, like a sissy shooting underhanded. I know I was wrong. I know some of the best foul shooters in history shot that way. Even now, the best one in the NBA, Rick Barry, shoots underhanded. I just couldn't do it. Some people are more easily embarrassed than others. While Rick Barry didn't care what people thought of him and shot free throws in a style others mocked, Wilt Chamberlain cared what others thought and didn't want to be ridiculed. As a leader, when you introduce changes, you have to take this kind of fear into account, and you have to be aware that people have different levels of tolerance to ridicule. Number three, people personalize change and may feel alone in the process. Most of the time when people experience change, particularly in businesses and organizations, they are not alone in the process, but they do often feel that way, and their emotions can overwhelm them. When anxiety rises, motivation falls. As leaders, we can become impatient and want them to get a grip and get over it. Instead, we need to show patience, acknowledge their humanness, and work with them. Not only will this help them process the change, but it will help us to influence them more quickly and move them forward. I confess that I didn't do this well as a young leader. I would often encourage people to ignore their feelings during times of change. I would tell them, "It's no big deal. We're all in this together. Don't worry about it." But that's like a dentist saying, "This won't hurt a bit." When you hear that, you know he's right. It won't hurt a bit. It will hurt a lot. As a young leader, I also made the mistake of treating change as if it were an event instead of a process. It took me a while to realize that people are always at different levels in their readiness to change. You can't just announce a change, implement it, and move on. That only causes resistance. You have to give people time and allow them to process changes. While not everyone will get on board or catch up, many will if you're willing to help them. Remember, the people are why you do what you do as a leader. How far can you travel isn't the point. It's how far you're able to take your people. That's the purpose of leadership. Leading people through change can be a lot like old jokes about how many people it takes to change a light bulb. It can be challenging and humorous. Here are some favorites of those jokes that I recently came across. How many actors does it take to change a light bulb? Answer, only one. They don't like to share the spotlight. How many academics does it take to change a light bulb? Answer, none. That's what research students are for. How many aerobics instructors does it take to change a light bulb? Answer, five. Four to do it in perfect synchrony, and one to stand there going, to the left, to the left, to the left, to the left, take it out, put it down, pick it up, put it in, to the right, to the right, to the right, to the right. Whew! How many aerospace engineers does it take to change a light bulb? None. It doesn't take a rocket scientist, you know. How many people at an American football game does it take to change a light bulb? Three. One to change it, and two to tip the entire contents of the ice bucket over the coach to congratulate him. How many American football players does it take to change a light bulb? Two. One to screw it in, and the other to recover the fumble. How many anglers does it take to change a light bulb? Five. And you should have seen the light bulb. It must have been this big. Five of us were barely enough. How many archaeologists does it take to change a light bulb? Three. One to change it, and two to argue how old the old one was. How many armies does it take to change a light bulb? Well, at least five. The Germans to start it, the French to give up really easily after only trying for a little while, the Italians to make a start, get nowhere, and then try again from the other side, and the Americans to turn up late and finish it off and take all the credit, and the Swiss to pretend nothing out of the ordinary is happening. One more. How many auto mechanics does it take to change a light bulb? Six. One to force it in with a hammer, and five to go after more light bulbs. I think the real question is, how many people does it take to create positive change? The answer is one person who's willing to lead the people involved in making the change through a process and do his best to take everyone with him. We overestimate the event, and we underestimate the process. After about 5 years of leadership experience, I finally figured out that I couldn't just change something and expect everyone to happily fall in behind me. At age 27, I was facing the need to introduce a big organizational change, the construction of a new building, and the repurposing of the existing one. And I realized that if I was going to succeed as a leader, I would need to develop a process to plan what needed to be changed, communicate it to the people, help them process the changes mentally and emotionally, and then put that plan into action. To do that, I developed something I called Plan Ahead. Yes, it's an acrostic, and that may seem hokey, but it makes it easy to remember and easy to teach other leaders. I've used it for almost 50 years, and it works. And I believe it will work for you. Here's what the acrostic represents. The letter P, predetermine the change that is needed. L, lay out your steps. A, adjust your priorities. N, notify key people. A, allow time for acceptance. H, head into action. E, experience problems. A, always point to the successes. D, daily review your progress. And here are the individual steps, and I encourage you to use them as you face the ultimate test of leadership, creating positive change. Let's go to P, predetermine the change that is needed. My friend Rick Warren, the founder of Saddleback Church, said, "The greatest enemy of tomorrow's success is yesterday's success." To be a good leader, you cannot become complacent. You cannot become satisfied with today's success. That means you need to not only welcome change, but champion it. If you don't, your team, department, or organization will be in trouble. You only need to read the first edition of the book, The 100 Best Companies to Work For in America, to know that is true. It was published in 1984. When the second edition was published 9 years later, nearly half of the original companies no longer existed. Identifying what needs changing in our organizations can be difficult because we become so accustomed to the problems that we no longer see them. That's what happened at British Rail in the 1970s. In 1977, the rail company's chairman, Sir Peter Parker, was trying to decide whether to give the advertising business to a huge established agency or to a smaller up-and-coming one. Finally, he made the decision, and all the British Rail executives came to the lobby, and they discovered that it was a grimy mess. The ashtrays were overflowing, half-empty coffee cups were left here and there, and magazines were laying on the floor. The receptionist didn't make the situation any better. One account says she ignored the group while making a personal phone call. Another says she smoked a cigarette while filing her nails and answered, don't know. Another says she smoked a cigarette while filing her nails and answered, don't know, to a question about how long the people would have to wait in the lobby. After waiting 20 minutes, Parker told the receptionist they were leaving. At that moment, Peter Marsh, the chairman of ABM, stepped in the reception area and said, "You've just seen what the public think of British Rail. Now let's see what we can do to put it right." As a leader, you carry the responsibility for reviewing your team and how it's looking and what it does and the needs that need to be changed. I like this standard for review. If you've done something for 1 year, look at it carefully. If you've done it for 2 years, look at it with suspicion. If you've done it for 5 years, stop looking at it and do something to change it. The first step is always predetermining what needs to be changed. Once you've recognized that, you can start looking at the second step. The letter L, lay out your steps. As I mentioned, I developed the plan ahead process in response to a big leadership challenge at my second church in Lancaster, Ohio. We were running out of space in our current facility, so I could see we needed to make changes. We needed to construct a new building and repurpose the old one. The problem was that the 1,500 people loved the facility and didn't want to change it. Furthermore, I needed to raise the money to build from that very same group of people. If I didn't lay out my steps carefully, I risked alienating everyone and failing to take them where I know they needed to go. I spent a good amount of time thinking through the process and carefully laid out my blueprint for successful change. I decided I needed to ask questions, listen to people's answers, discuss the challenges, and empower key leaders to search for answers to our space problem. I let that run its course for a year, and as I hoped and expected, the leaders came to the same conclusion that I had and recommended the course of action I also believed that was best. But by then, they came to the table with evidence to support their conclusion. They had bought into it personally, and they convinced others to join them. Was I happy to move so slowly? No. But I knew the task was huge, and as the saying goes, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. That's what we were doing. And each step forward increased our confidence and strengthened my leadership. The letter A, adjust your priorities. In the movie, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, the main character tells his daughter, I hope you live the life you are proud of. If you find that you are not, I hope you find the strength to start over again. In other words, he was saying that if we want to change for the better, we need to revise our priorities to be successful. The biggest danger for leaders at this stage of the process is to confuse cosmetic changes for critical ones. Cosmetic changes are easier to make, but are not effective because they don't address things that really matter. They occur outside in. Critical changes are made from the inside out, and they are always more difficult to facilitate. Leaders who focus on the wrong things are like Charlie Brown from the Peanuts cartoon strip by Charles Schulz. Charlie tells his friend Linus, For as long as I've lived, whenever I put on my shoes, I've always put the left one on first. Then suddenly last week, I put the right one on first. Every day this week, I've been putting my right shoe on first. And you know what? It hasn't changed my life a bit. Critical changes make an impact. They also cost you something in time, energy, resources, creativity, goodwill, or influence. If they don't cost you, you need to question if real change is occurring. Of course, not changing also costs you. If I had chosen to throw in the towel as we were running out of space in Lancaster, the entire organization would have plateaued, and it would have been the beginning of the end. Instead, as the core leadership team came together, we changed our priorities and prepared for the next step in the process. The letter N stands for Notify Key People. Good leaders don't share information about changes with everyone in the organization at one time. They don't try to make communication fair. They make it strategic. As a leader, before you let the masses know what's going on, you need to meet with the key people and communicate with them. Which key people? I identify them by asking myself two questions. Who needs to get behind this and make it fly? And who actually has to fly it? The answer to those questions point to me, the people who need to know about changes before everyone else does. I meet first with the people whose influence is needed to make the changes fly. Because if they don't buy in, the plan is never going to work. I'll need to work with them to earn their buy-in. Usually these meetings occur one-on-one or in very small groups. I often take an approach that I wrote about in the chapter Share a Secret with Someone in my book 25 Ways to Win with People. By telling them about the change before it's public knowledge, I'm giving them valuable information, making them feel special, and including them on the journey. It's an act of inclusion that most people appreciate. This personal approach also allows for open discussion, honest reactions, questions, and objections. I think of these connection times as the meetings before the meeting. If these go well, I share the information with the people who care the most, the ones who will carry out the implementation of the plan. After that, I began to hold other meetings with larger groups throughout the organization. And if a meeting before the meeting doesn't go well, then I meet with those key individuals again and keep meeting with them until we can work through their objections and they buy into the change. The key players on the team or in the organization must be willing participants and involved in the process for it to work. That takes care of the plan, P-L-A-N, part of the process. Now let's look ahead at the next part based upon the word ahead. The letter A stands for allow time for acceptance. People usually take a long time to accept change, and usually that acceptance goes through three phases. One, it will not work. Two, it will cost too much. And number three, I thought it was a good idea all along. Seriously, though, allowing time for acceptance is a challenge leaders face because they often see more and before their people do. And the announcement of change can be confusing, misunderstood, or even chaos-producing on the team or within the organization. Recently, I was reading 8 Steps to Achieve Your Destiny, Lead Your Life with Purpose by my friend Sam Chan. In a chapter called New Perspectives, he wrote about the need for leaders to keep changing. But his observations equally apply to changes a leader implements in an organization. Sam wrote, "Change is always necessary. We cannot assume that just because something works today, it will continue to work tomorrow. You must either evolve or stagnate. Most leaders and nearly all followers only recognize the need for change after decline has set in. They don't take action until something is broken." This is illustrated by point B on Charles Handy's Sigmund Curve. At that point, the best they can do is put the brakes on to slow it down, begin some crisis management, and put a spin on it. When you're ahead of the curve and making changes, no one may understand what you're doing or why you're doing it. That period between implementing change and others beginning to see what you saw is aptly shown as chaos. Good leaders always allow time for acceptance. But when they find that acceptance is slow in coming, or the people are experiencing the chaos Sam Chan described, they take additional measures to help people adapt to the change. Here are 3 things that you can do in situations such as these. 1, slow down. If you plow ahead and don't take into consideration the slow response of your people, they will begin to make negative assumptions about you. They might think, you lack preparation, you're hiding the real agenda, you're railroading through your agenda, you lack concern for what people think and feel. Any one of these beliefs will diminish your influence, and they all create greater barriers to change. The solution is to slow down and give your people time. Keep encouraging them, keep answering questions, but don't force the issue. 2, make your communication clear and simple. A second thing you can do is to work hard to communicate clearly and simply as people process the changes and come around. Academia takes something simple and makes it complicated. A communicator takes something complicated and makes it simple. As a leader who strives to simplify my message, I ask myself some questions to help me communicate more effectively. Do I understand what I'm going to say? Will they understand what I'm going to say? Will they be able to tell others what I say? And will others understand what they say? Why do I do that? Because people will not accept what they cannot understand. In addition, you want the people who do process and accept the change to help others do the same. They can do that only if they can communicate the ideas clearly. By simplifying the message before you deliver it, you give people who buy in something clear and memorable to say to others as they advocate for change. Roberto Goizetta was Coca-Cola's chairman, director, and CEO from 1980 to 1997. During his tenure, he made Coca-Cola the most recognized brand in the world. In his book, 212 Leadership, author Mac Anderson wrote of the Cuban-born